This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Duke University loses six black professors. Did the charges of sexual assault by the lacrosse team play a role in their departure? And is the war keeping us safe at home? Joining us to discuss these topics and others from our New York bureau, Robert George. He's an editorial writer with the New York Post. From member station WBUR in Boston, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's co-director of immigration studies at New York University. And Laura Washington with the Chicago Sun-Times. She's a columnist there. She joins us from our Chicago bureau. All right, folks, greatly appreciate your time today. Let's get right into it. We are seeing headlines from an alleged attack in 2003 that would have taken place on the New York subway. Al-Qaeda terrorists talked about killing thousands of New Yorkers by spreading cyanide gas in the subways. This is part of a new book, The 1% Doctrine, that talks about the inevitable attack on the United States once again. We also hear Laura Washington from the vice president this week suggesting that the war in Iraq is partly responsible for the absence of these kinds of attacks here in the United States.
Well, I think this is not surprising coming from the vice president. I think we have to separate the argument that we have remained safe from terrorism and because of the Iraq war, because of our war on terrorism. We had to separate the rationale that we went to war to stop terrorism, which is certainly not the case. We have to separate that from the issue of whether or not we are safer. I think there's a compelling case to be made that there haven't been any incidents, even despite these plots that you mentioned, and I'm sure there are many others, that we have been protected. The flip side of that, I think, though, is that I think we have been lulled into a sort of a sense of complacency that we're back to business as usual. I was in New York just this past weekend, and I was spent some time in the subways, and I was really amazed at how casual and how relaxed folks. Well, if you really can't say people in New York are ever really relaxed,
but I've never heard that.
But you know, going about their business, you know, business as usual. No, and I saw a couple folks, you know, here and there that might have raised my eyebrows. But I think that we have been lulled into this sense that things are back to business, that we are protected because of the absence of a terrorist attack, and I think that that's a dangerous trend.
Marcelo, the vice president, let me quote him here, says, quote, "The fact is we've taken the battle to the enemy. That's been the key to the safety and security of the American people these last few years, and we need to continue to do it," end quote.
Well, that's confabulating really two very, very different processes. I think that it's probably much more related to the work of our police, of our security services in the big cities that have worked to foil these attempted plots than what is going on in Iraq. But let's face it, this continues the narrative we've heard from day one, the confabulation of the war in Iraq with international terrorism. And the preponderance of evidence suggests that worldwide there is more terrorism today. We've seen the attacks in London. We've seen the attacks in Madrid. This is not really, there is no empirical or really conceptual, logical grounds for claiming that the war in Iraq has been directly related to the absence of an attack, another attack, in the U.S. I think it has to do with the hard work of our police.
Robert George, if that's true, that there's no real empirical evidence that we can show, doesn't that help the White House in their goal to try to marry these two issues?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. By the way, I want to assure Laura that, you know, it is in New York is as safe as it's ever been. You don't have to worry. You're welcome here anytime.
As it's ever been. Well, that's not necessarily safe.
I was hoping you wouldn't pay attention to what I said.
Spoken by the guardian of New York, Robert George. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, it's you're absolutely right, and it really it does speak to people say, well, you know, oh, they're right. You know, there has not been an attack here, so they must be doing something right. But I mean, it would be nice to point out that, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, 9/11 was something of an aberration. It was not the completely and totally the new normal that people want to assume that it was. You know, keep in mind that there were it was close to 8 years between the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center and the 2001 successful destruction of the World Trade Center. Now, obviously, that means that there were plots, you know, in between there and so forth. But because back then we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know we only learned actually about the Millennium plot later on as well. The point is that government's primary job every single day, whether there's a war in Iraq or not, is to keep the people at home safe. And I think it would be a good idea in the context of public policy, you know, to keep in mind when they say, oh well, there hasn't been an attack, you know, it's a variation of that Chris Rock line, you know that's what you're supposed to do, that's the standard mark. It's not just necessarily a special event.
Yet, Marcelo, I remember Tom Ridge, the first head of Homeland Security, talking about how really almost impossible it is to try to thwart all of what will occur in the United States over the next, well, I guess forever now, if you believe the world has changed. The idea that they get so many, quote, chatters across the line every day, it's almost impossible to safeguard us.
Indeed, what we've learned over the last decade is that open societies are very vulnerable, and they are very, very difficult to protect at all times. And again, we only have to make one mistake to be very, very vulnerable, which really goes to the heart of the other story that we've been discussing, having to do with how are funds then for the security of the homeland allocated. Should a city like New York City, for example, should the cities that are obvious targets, should they be the focus of additional security, additional funding to prevent and to do the kind of hard investigative work that needs to be done in the context of a democratically open society that is otherwise very vulnerable.
Ed, you know, Margaret Thatcher once famously said, you know, that the bad guys, you know, only have to be lucky once, whereas we have to be lucky 100% of the time, and that really goes to the heart of the challenge that you have in terms of trying to make the country and particularly the large urban areas safe.
Yeah, and there are others, Laura, that are simply saying that this is, again, just a political tool for the White House to try to find some justification for the war.
Of course, and you expect the White House to use every tool at its disposal. But I think that Marcelo's point about funding and resources is a really important one to remember. There's a lot of focus right now on how much money we're putting into security, and all that focus is on the amount of money and not how it's being spent. You know, do we need 2,000 security cameras in New York subways? Is that the best way to combat our security problems? If you look at the way we spent money to combat the devastation of the hurricanes in the Gulf area, we spent billions of dollars both before and afterwards, and look where it got us. So I think we really have to look a lot more closely at strategies and not just focus on the big cities, because the terrorists know where our vulnerabilities are. And if we're putting all the money in the big cities, what about the
I'm much more confident in what the NYPD is doing, frankly, than anything else that's going on in terms of protecting the way the city is going.
All right, let me move to the next topic, and that is we are seeing a departure of six African-American professors from Duke University this summer. Some are wondering whether or not we're seeing this departure in part because of the rape scandal case that continues to plague that university. While a few of the professors had already announced their departure, some are suggesting that it is because of the way the university has handled it that has helped others push themselves across the line and go to other universities. Marcelo, some will say that this is just the tone and tenor of universities today, that they are rated often like we used to see corporate rating back in the 80s. How much of that is the reality today in terms of the way the college world is?
Well, that is a reality, Ed, but when you have six very eminent, very senior scholars depart a major research university, then you really have to ask what's going on there in terms of the climate, what's going on there in terms of the larger institutional culture that makes it easy for, again, not one, not two, six senior professors to decamp. If I were Provost Lang, I guess, is the provost of Duke, I'd really be worried today about what this tells us about the climate at the university that is so makes it so that a large contingent of senior members of the faculty chose to leave.
Here's what's interesting here, Laura. Mark Anthony Neal, who's an associate professor of African American Studies at Duke and a commentator on this program, talked about the idea that that's what happens when you have good professors, particularly minority professors, as does Duke. They are often raided. He did not believe necessarily that, at least in a couple of professors' cases, the lacrosse scandal had anything to do with it. Yet the university and Mr. Lang has suggested, as Marcelo talked about the provost there, that they are really gaining a net four, that they'll be gaining 10 black faculty members this year. So 10 minus 6 plus 4.
Do the math.
I think
the point here is that we are in a very highly competitive environment at the university level, and when it comes to high profile, very accomplished professors. There's competition. Folks are rating universities all over this country, and they're doing it for three big reasons. One, because of the publicity these universities get with these high-profile folks on staff, because of the prestige is associated with it, and because of the money that these folks bring in, both in terms of students, new students. It's the competition is about getting students. And I think in the case of African-American professors, it's very important for students who are considering universities to know that there is a welcoming environment, at least in terms of the faculty, in terms of mentoring opportunities, that kind of thing. If I were the provost, I would be more concerned about going forward, trying to figure out a way to get folks that are going to be very nurturing and be good mentors, because Duke is obviously a very scarred place right now, and that's what I would be looking for. Not so much the folks that have left, but who am I going to bring on?
Robert George, here's what's interesting, and let me broaden the question here or the scope of it and take a look at Duke University and this scandal in general. We are now seeing Republicans moving forward to try to run against the prosecutor there that has been very controversial during this case, because there is a growing sentiment amongst people in Durham and across the country, quite frankly, that this case may in fact not be what the accuser is suggesting the longer it goes.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, obviously, we will say, you know, that the defense has been very, very good in terms of their selective leaks and so forth. However, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And I would also underscore that, as African Americans, we should really underscore the importance of saying, you know, people are innocent until proven guilty. And in this case, that includes the white people charged here. And I would say that one of the leaks that's come out is that the other woman involved in this has basically discounted the fact that there was a rape as well. And so it's not surprising that this has also created political overtones for the prosecutor bringing the indictments in the first place. But I would also say, just in terms of the main point we were talking here, I just think it's great. I think it's just really great that black professors, with Duke or otherwhere, anywhere else, are in high demand. That they are in fact getting raided. Particularly since we actually mentioned a little bit in the first segment, about the roles of where black people are on campus, whether we're talking about women, men, or otherwise. The fact that other institutions want to have high profile black professors on their campuses to help bring in others is a great thing.
Let me also note, as you talk about guilt and innocence and in this country still believing in the ideal of guilty and or innocent until proven guilty, we should also note that African-American women should be afforded the same belief as a white woman in these charges, and that is not often
that is fair, you know, but that, of course, is one of the major, you know, special cases involving, you know, involving rape, that too often the man is presumed guilty just because of the accusation.
All right, very quickly, with literally about 2.5 minutes to go, Laura, let me start with you. Mm-hmm. The grand jury has declined to indict Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney with the flap with the Capitol Hill police, the famous confrontation there.
Right, and this would appear to be a vindication. You know what they say about grand juries, they'll indict a ham sandwich. So the fact that the grand jury chose not to pass on an indictment here, I think we have to accept that as vindication of her innocence. And I think because you're not going to hear anywhere near as much publicity or attention on this move as you did on the original story. And I think that the country is going to continue to be divided about whether or not she was just crying wolf and whether or not she really had a case of racial profiling.
That's the big question, whether or not we should allow this to die an easy death or whether we should continue to beg the question of whether or not this was truly racial profiling.
Well, clearly she was vindicated, which means that her side of the story from the very beginning is the side of the story that should stand.
Well, I would say that, you know, sometimes just because a grand jury does not indict does not necessarily mean that the person acted completely appropriately. I mean, as some people would point out, say in the Karl Rove situation when he was not indicted by the grand jury. I will say, of course, I think though it is very difficult, you know, to bring, you know, an indictment against a member of Congress, and I think that they sometimes are afforded special treatment, a la Patrick Kennedy. In another case that was somewhat resolved last week.
But you're not implying, certainly, that this was not a case or this was not the case for Ms. McKinney.
Whether there was special treatment. Well, let me put it this way. I don't think it was a case of racial profiling, and the most noticeable aspect of that, I think, frankly, is that no member of the Congressional Black Caucus agreed with her in that area. Some of them supported her in general, but they did not say that it was a case of racial profiling. And I think we should, if that's a real serious issue, we shouldn't just say that just because a member of Congress happens to get you know, irritated, that what she says is necessarily the case.
All right. All right, Robert, Marcello, and Laura, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.